A grandfather crafts a dollhouse for his granddaughter's fourth birthday. She plays with it constantly, moving dolls from room to room, staging mini dramas in her mind. And then one day, she decides to clean the dollhouse floor, taking abrasive comet and a toothbrush to the delicate wood. The guilt of breaking the house her grandfather built haunted Julie Denechet for years. It wasn't until she was doing a story for KCUR that Julie realized that making mistakes is part of what toys are for. That's how we learn from them. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and Julie's story got us thinking, what is the importance of play? What is its role in development, and what is the influence of technology on play well into adulthood? That's coming up on Central Standard, right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. As kids, we have elaborate, complex, and highly personal relationships with our toys. We own them, we hopefully learn to share them, we have fun with them, and we typically outgrow them. Years later, what do we take with us from those experiences? I'm Gina Kaufman, and on Central Standard today, we're going to revisit our childhood toys, looking at them through an entirely different lens, exploring the important lessons they were teaching us all along when we thought we were just having fun. I'd like to start by introducing our first guest, Megan Patterson. She is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Kansas, where her research focuses on the development of personal and group identity. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning.
So, on a very basic level, why do people play?
Well, there's a number of reasons that people play. I mean, the most important reason that we play is because it's fun. So that's the sort of defining quality of play, is we're doing it because it's fun and we enjoy it and we're not required to do it. But we also know that children absolutely learn things from play. They learn from playing with toys, things like spatial relations. When we play with dolls, we learn nurturing skills, things like that. And we also learn to interact with other people through play. So when we learn to play games and negotiate rules and things like that, we learn those kinds of skills as well.
My second guest here today is Bradley Debrick, who comes to us from the Johnson County Library, where he's Early Childhood Literacy Coordinator. Hi, Bradley.
Good morning, Gina.
And in a nutshell, why do you use play in terms of literacy? What do these two things have to do with one another?
We have installed early literacy play spaces in all 13 of our libraries, and we encourage adult-child interaction with toys, manipulatives, games, books that we provide. All of the activities in our centers impact one or more of the six pre-reading skills we've identified as part of our 6x6 Ready to Read program.
Well, we'll be getting back to some expertise from both Megan and Bradley, but I'd like to now introduce Mary Jo Ward, one of the owners of Brookside Toy and Science, a brick-and-mortar toy store that's been around since 1964. And although child-rearing and toy trends have changed over the decades, the store itself, by comparison, has been pretty consistent in its approach. Would you say that's right, Mary Jo Ward?
I would say that's exactly true, and many of the things that we carry today are the same tried and true learning toys that we sold 60 years ago.
How did you get into the toy business, and when did you come on board?
My mother-in-law had five children, and she lived near Brookside, and she was running in there all the time, and so she bought it for her as a business for herself. I was a teacher, and when I married my husband and moved to Kansas City, I fell right into it. By the way, my favorite game to play role-playing was Store as a child.
So you had some good training.
Yes, I did.
So when you became a part of this store and you had been trained as a teacher, what do you think is maybe similar about running a toy store as being a teacher? Are the roles similar?
I would say pretty much. Children learn easiest when they're happy and engaged, and toys provide that.
Well, as I mentioned, toy trends change, but on some level, a kid is a kid. So what would you say has maybe changed in your years in the business, and what hasn't?
Well, I would say that we definitely see more technology in toys. However, we at Brookside stay away from some of that. I do see we sell way more science-oriented toys. Parents are very aware of wanting to get the best education for their kids through toys.
So parental awareness is part of what has changed?
I would say, yeah. Our parents are pretty educated and aware that they want their kids to advance as much as they can.
Well,
but we also, in many ways, a ball is a ball, and and it'll always provide great fun and skills to that, too.
Megan, what do you think? Are toys part of every culture? Play, it seems like, is a natural part of development. But the toy, is that variable from culture to culture?
Yes and no. So definitely play is a part of every culture. And actually, we see play even in non-human animals. Most cultures have some form of toys. What that is going to vary from culture to culture. And there are some cultures, certainly, where people don't have a lot of possessions. But even in those, you'll see kids playing with empty cans and things like that. It's also true that we often, across cultures, see toys that are designed to teach children the kinds of skills we want them to have when they're adults. So if a culture spends a lot of time on weaving, and that's an important skill in their culture, then kids will have weaving toys, things like that. So we see the types of toys being different from culture to culture, but most cultures have some level of toys for kids.
When you mention weaving and the idea that the adults in a culture might want to train a child through the use of toys that teach specific intentional skills, there's also this aspect of play when you observe little kids where you're not sure who's in charge, really, the toy or the kid. I've seen my nephew turn leaves into superheroes. So how do you bring that kind of intentionality to a toy?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that it's not necessarily always that, you know, adults buy a toy and they give it to a kid to achieve a goal. Certainly, kids pick their own toys and they will make toys out of things. So certainly, pretending that objects are other objects is a really common aspect of play. So I'm not sure how much we need to be directing play in that way. I think letting kids direct their own play is part of what makes play fun, you know, letting them make things into other things and figure out what kinds of goals they want to achieve and what problems they want to solve is part of what makes play both fun and helpful for promoting cognitive development.
Are there differences in how children play at different developmental stages?
Absolutely. So as kids get older, their play tends to become more interactive and also more cooperative. So as we move from, you know, toddlerhood into the preschool and elementary school years, we're better at coordinating our actions with other people. We start seeing more use of games with rules and things like that. So we definitely see play changing with development. We also see certain types of play kind of become more common at certain stages and then less common later. So pretend play, for example, that's very common in the preschool years. It's less common as kids move into the elementary school years and get older.
What is the role of a toy when it comes to play? And can things go wrong in this process?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think play is one of those places where there's not necessarily a right or wrong. So if you're, you know, taking a toy that's meant to be used in a certain way and you're doing something else with it, making it into something different, then you're being creative. And that's a good aspect of play. I think certainly toys can promote certain types of play. So if you're provided with blocks, you're probably going to play differently than if you're provided with a doll, for example. And so, if we want to encourage certain skills or certain types of play, the toys we provide can help to do that.
Bradley, another kind of toy that you might play with differently is a toy that has a little screen and buttons on it. How do you think that technology factors into this? I know there's a lot of parental and educator concern out there about some of the unknowns in that arena.
The research on especially apps that are labeled as educational is still very sketchy. The idea of having apps as a learning tool is still new. The majority of apps for kids only teach letter sounds and alphabet, and up to 95% of apps that you can download or purchase only teach those two literacy skills. So we're still trying to find ways to balance a child's desire to have technology and the pass-back effect where parents pass their iPhone back to the back seat at a stoplight to balance that desire with a more holistic approach of how to give kids a well-rounded basis or foundation for learning.
What does a physical technological toy is physical, but what is something that you physically manipulate do that maybe something that's happening on a screen does not accomplish?
Well, I'm hopeful that if you're physically manipulating an object or an item, you're with someone else. We really try to focus on the intentional interactions between an adult and a child or two children. Dr. Patterson mentioned kids playing together when they get older, the socio-symbolic nature of playing together, becoming a character, being in character, cause and effect, moving things around. All of that helps build a deep understanding, which is how things work in the world. And when you're alone with a flat screen that may only, I hate to be too simple, but it may only change a shape or cause a bell or a whistle, there's not a deep understanding of how things interact.
Explain what you mean by that, becoming a character.
For instance, if you have a puppet stage and you become a character at that puppet stage, you're acting in character, you're talking appropriately, you're doing things that that character would, which may be different from you yourself. Then you add in another child, and they have to work together to create a dialogue that's appropriate for that scene that, again, may not be a scene that they've ever been in. So they're making something up. They're giving themselves a deeper understanding of the situation and how people act and react together.
Well, this idea of screen time is sort of a popular concept. What can you tell us about screen time and its role in early childhood development?
The American Academy of Pediatricians has long said that there should be no screen time for children under two. And in the public library, we want to support professional organizations, but we also realize that that's almost impossible. I was recently at a restaurant and sat in the corner, and I was able to count 34 screens in my environment. Children cannot avoid screens. Just in our library, we have computers, e-readers, digital messaging screens. Some of our storytime leaders use screens to project rhymes and songs. It is just impossible. The focus we're moving is a concept by Lisa Guernsey called the three C's. You focus on the content, the context, and your individual child. And you approach screen time from that perspective. Screen time may not be bad for your child, but it may be replacing something that could be even better.
That makes sense. Megan, what are your thoughts?
I think Bradley's point absolutely is correct, that idea that screen time isn't necessarily bad. We just don't want it to replace or take over from interactions that might be more beneficial. So, and there has been research certainly looking particularly at children's ability to learn from screens, to learn from videos and things like that. And we find that older kids, and by older kids, I mean at least preschool and elementary school age kids, sometimes can learn well from programs like Sesame Street or Blue's Clues, things like that. But very young children, infants and toddlers, seem not to learn very well from screens.
What kinds of things are kids at that age supposed to be learning from play? Is that part of why they're maybe less effective at that stage?
Yeah, I think the research seems to suggest that those very young children in particular really need that social interaction. So they learn a lot better from interacting with parents or from other people in their environments than they do from screens to learn, new words and things like that.
Mary Jo Ward, how prevalent are technologically based toys in your store?
I would say 2%. We really discourage them because I so agree with your two experts. Children need to react with other people, and that is how they learn to cooperate and to share and to have skills, verbal skills, and all that is so important. And they learn to be creative.
Well, what are some of the toys that have been tried and trusted over the years that you've witnessed some real creativity around, by witnessing so many children interacting with toys?
Well, I would say blocks. A child can play with a block one way and add on to it or try something and it doesn't work and try again. And so they learn cause and effect. Role playing is another area where people learn to put on a costume or act like a doctor, or we still sell tea sets and cash registers. All these provide learning skills, but the best is when you're interacting and an adult is interacting with the child, they try things in new ways and they talk to each other.
Mary Jo, what about Legos? Those have always been big.
When I say blocks, Legos continue to be fantastic. And I do wish that parents would buy more of a big bucket of Legos rather than a set that is building a specific item.
Huh. But, explain that.
Quite often, I suppose it's a way of branding so that if you have a big bucket of Legos, you still need to have more Legos. But Lego comes in themes. My favorite themes are something called the creator themes, which they will show you how to build three different things. There's a theme that are Ninjago, which I believe is a program, a cartoon on television, sort of a space alien theme. There's police themes, there's a girl's friends theme, but basically it's nice when you can just create. And by the way, this friends theme, themes are good because not only do they build these environments, then they do role play with the Legos.
Well, I want to get back to that idea of role-playing in just a second, but we want to know from our listeners, what toy from your childhood taught you a lesson that you remember and implement to this day? Call us at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. We want to hear your thoughts and stories, or maybe you can't figure out what a certain toy was supposed to be teaching you at all. Our guests will do their best to help you get to the bottom of it. Call 816-235-2888 to speak with Bradley Debrick of the Johnson County Public Library, Megan Patterson from KU's Psychology Department, and Mary Jo Ward of the Brookside Toy and Science Store that's been around since 1964. Megan, Dr. Patterson, we were just listening to this explanation of how the toy with a certain instruction about what you're supposed to do with it differs from just being presented with the toy and figuring out what to do. Developmentally, what's the difference?
Well, certainly, I think there's research suggesting that those toys where the child figures out what to do with it can promote a different set of skills. So the ability to solve problems, creativity, something called executive function, which is about the ability to regulate and control your thinking and behavior, which research suggests is a really important skill for lots of things, including academic performance. Now, certainly, toys that have more specific directions can be beneficial as well. Learning how to follow directions is also an important skill. But I think there's also some research suggesting that those directions can sometimes inhibit. So there was a study done by Elizabeth Bonowitz at MIT, where they had this really cool toy where if you, pulled on this part, it made this sound. And if you pushed this part, it lit up and all this kind of stuff. And in one condition, they had kids come into the lab and the researcher showed them some of the things the toy did, but not all of them. And in another condition, they just handed the kid the toy and said, here you go. And what they found was the kids who just got the toy without any instructions from an adult actually discovered more of the things that the toy did. So giving children that freedom to explore can actually help them to discover more about what they can do.
That's interesting. Do you have, in your research, have you stumbled across a toy that you think provides that opportunity really, really well?
Oh, I think there are a lot of toys that can provide that opportunity. But honestly, I think one of the best things that provides the opportunity to explore and figure out how things are going to happen is nature. So just going out in the world to the park or your backyard or the creek down the street and poking at things with sticks and seeing what happens. I think that's actually one of the best ways to do that.
I agree. When you think about toys and what they do versus nature and what it does, part of that equation, of course, is a word that Mary Jo Ward brought up, which is branding. How do you tease out the real value of something from kind of how it's being branded?
Sure. And that can be difficult because we know kids get exposed to a lot of advertising and will often ask for things they see on television. And we know also young kids aren't very good at telling the difference between advertising and a program. So they don't know what the purpose of advertising is. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be that balance for individual parents and individual families between, you know, what do you think is best for the kid and what does the child want and things like that, and helping them to fit in with peers and all of those different kinds of things. So it can be hard to figure out what's, you know, really a useful toy versus what's just popular right now. So I think the best thing for parents and other adults to do is just think about, you know, what kinds of, you know, skills or actions do you want your child to be developing, and then does this toy encourage that or not? What do you want your child to learn from this toy, and is the toy or the experience going to teach that or not?
So, Megan, we've asked our listeners if they have a memory of a toy that taught them something or that really sticks with them to this day. What about you?
Well, I definitely have a memorable toy. I'm not entirely sure what I learned from it, but when I was young, actually from birth, I had a stuffed bunny named Bunny. Not a very creative child, I'll admit. And I loved it so much. I carried it with me everywhere, and it just got very worn and bedraggled and all of that. And I remember when I was a little older, my parents reading to me The Velveteen Rabbit, about the story of a little boy who has this stuffed rabbit that he also loves very much, and it gets very worn and bedraggled as well. And I just loved that story because he had a rabbit that he loved just like I did.
It sounds to me like maybe you learned something about taxonomy, putting things in categories. You called your bunny Bunny.
Yes,
you know?
I think maybe so. Maybe so. So learning about those categories. But also just learning about, particularly with the Velveteen Rabbit, I think learning about other people's experiences and thinking about their feelings, that other people could have those same feelings and experiences that I was having, which is definitely something kids are learning in those preschool years about other people's feelings and how to take their perspectives, things like that.
Bradley, what about you? Do you have a toy memory?
I do. I wasn't a huge Star Wars fan as a child, but I do remember having little figurines or action figures of Darth Vader and Chewbacca. And I didn't use them as the characters they were, but I did notice that on their feet, from where the plastic was molded, there were two little holes. And to me, that meant they could fly. So those characters and I flew inside and outside and up the stairs, and I never used them as Star Wars characters. I used them as my friends who could fly.
That's awesome, having friends who can fly. Mary Jo Ward, I hear you trying to get in on this.
Oh, I'm agreeing. I think these are fantastic.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to one of our callers. We've got Russ on the line from Lewisburg. Hi, Russ.
Hello. Hi there. Hey, I've always found, as when I was a kid, and I was quite old, I am quite old, Tinker toys were made of wood and Erector sets are just made out of metal. But toys that come without instructions or minimal instructions, such as don't eat the parts, are, I think, what I found most enjoyable. Things where you could be totally freeform and do whatever you wanted. Plus, living in the middle of a national forest didn't hurt either. There was lots to learn out there, from climbing up and looking at squirrels' nests to anything else. But I think having a free childhood without toy weapons or G.I. Joes served me well. I've become an engineer, and I like being an engineer.
Do you ever, in your engineering work, think about something, like, kind of ever picture your Tinker Toys or your Lincoln Logs as a frame of reference, or is that pushing it?
It's not pushing it. I don't think of the Tinker Toys as the Lincoln Logs so much, but the Erector sets taught me lessons that I use to this day, and I tend sometimes to, you know, if I need to solve a problem, I will go to the Home Depot or whatever's nearby, pick up chunks of steel and screws, and, you know, make whatever's necessary to implement a particular sort of bracket that the manufacturer never thought I would need, that sort of thing. So, you know, actually, life is a bunch of Tinker Toys and Erector sets when it comes to my occupation.
Thanks so much for calling, Russ.
No worries. You have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Russ just mentioned Erector sets, which I don't know if those are around anymore. Mary Jo Ward, did you ever sell Erector sets at your store?
I did, and I currently still do. We love Erector sets.
Explain how they work.
In their the most basic sets are a piece of metal and screws. And they configure, they do often come with instructions, but you don't have to follow them, and you can build whatever you want. The more elaborate sets do come with a motor, so you can build a model most sets, you can build at least 30 models, 40 models. It's a price point piece count thing. And you can build a working model with an erector set, a vehicle, a crane, and we strongly recommend that kind of construction toy.
Jump in here, Bradley.
I want to just comment on something that Ms. Ward said about the instructions that come with the erector set. You're right that kids don't have to use those, and like I'm sure Russ was able to build tons of things without them. But for some kids, not having instructions is very uncomfortable, and they like to have a direction. They like to have a purpose. They like to know where they're going. So I think for parents who purchase an erector set and their kids seem, you know, less likely to take to it, maybe they need that guidance. And using that instruction manual or looking up images of what other people have built can give those kids a sense of comfort to build on their own. We've seen that in the library where we have signs that we encourage a certain type of play, but some kids need that direction and others will just play freely. So it's important to know that some kids do need some direction.
And Dr. Patterson, you had mentioned that learning how to follow instructions is part of what a toy can teach.
Sure, absolutely. And as Bradley said, I think it's absolutely true that some kids are going to feel more comfortable with some adult direction. And so it's important for parents and other people who work with kids to know the individual child. I always like to remind people, kids are people just like adults are, and so they're going to have individual differences.
Let's talk to Joe in Shawnee.
Good morning.
Hi.
So I wanted to comment on the childhood toy that we played with and then learned a lesson from it and still use it today as an adult. As a child, I was very much into Legos, and I very specifically remember a time that I was trying to build a castle without instructions. You know, I was just putting it together with the pieces that I had, and I couldn't make the gate work the way I wanted it to, so I got frustrated and smashed all of my work. And I'd spent many hours trying to put this together, and it made me very upset that I had destroyed, you know, this piece of art that I had created. And I remember my parents sitting me down and saying, look, you know, we understand that you're frustrated, but next time, why don't you just take a break before you react and, you know, collect your thoughts, think about how you can make it work better, and then come back to it later with a fresh mind. And I've taken that lesson all the way up to now as a 32-year-old adult. When I get frustrated with things, I'll step back and remove myself from the situation and think about it and then come back with a clear mind.
Coping with frustration is maybe a pretty important skill a toy can teach. It's not all about the toy being used successfully.
Absolutely, yeah. So as the caller was saying, that ability to deal with things that aren't working out. So when something isn't working the way you wanted it to, what's an alternative path? What's a different solution? And how do you deal with those feelings that come up when things aren't working out the way you want to? We can learn that from toys or from play with other people.
Well, we will get back to this conversation with Megan Patterson, Bradley Debrick, and Mary Jo Ward all about play and its importance. We want your calls at 816-235-2888 or via Twitter at KCURCST. Central Standard will be right back after this break. What toy from your childhood taught you a lesson that you remember and implement to this day? Call us at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard, and we're talking today about the importance of play and the role of toys in play, what we learn from that process, and how that carries over into our adult lives. I'm joined here by Megan Patterson, who's from the psychology department at the University of Kansas. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning.
And with Bradley Debrick from the Johnson County Library, where he is Early Child Literacy Coordinator. Good morning, Bradley.
Hi, Gina.
And so we are hearing from a lot of our callers, and we'll get to them in a second. We'll return to their stories. But something that's kind of interesting is the role of gender in play. Do you think that the toys that children are presented, sometimes based on whether it's a boy or a girl, do you think that that influences gender identity?
I think certainly there's evidence that boys and girls get different kinds of toys, and this is probably driven partly by adults and partly by the kids themselves. So boys and girls ask for different kinds of toys. And that probably does influence their outcome. So I noticed both of our callers, who were both men, mentioned, tinker toys and erector sets and Legos and these building kinds of toys. And I think there is some evidence that those kinds of toys influence spatial relations ability, which is one of the things we know that men tend to do better at than women in adulthood. And it may be the case that boys' experience with those building kinds of toys helps to develop those spatial relation skills. And that's one of the reasons men turn out better than women on that skill on average as adults.
When boys and girls are asking for different toys, what do you think accounts for that?
I think there's a number of factors. One certainly is media. So what kinds of characters they see on television, what kinds of advertisements they see within those programs. Also peers. So what do they see their peers at preschool or at school playing with? And we do know that kids will frequently enforce gender norms there at daycare, at school, saying, this is a girl's toy, this is a boy's toy, and you can't play with that because that's a boy's toy and you're a girl. Children are often much more direct and explicit about those gendered expectations than adults are.
Bradley, what have you observed in the children in your groups? Do you think that some of the playing and role playing, do you think that there's anything gendered about what you're observing?
I honestly can't say that I've seen anything that I felt was gendered in any way. We do make a pretty intentional effort to purchase toys that are inexpensive, that people can replicate in their own home. So they see it at the library, they take it home. For instance, right now we're doing a matching game using muffin tins. Well, everyone has a muffin tin and they can do that at home. We don't do a lot of buying items or creating items that we feel are, well, boys are going to like this, girls are going to like that. Our activity kit for Put It on the List, which is a shopping-based kit, boys and girls both enjoy that one a lot. Our kit based on Tip Tip Dig Dig by Emma Garcia is all construction and trucks, and we figured that boys would gravitate to that, but we don't see a difference. We see boys and girls both running to those toys, those trucks, those muffin tins, the shopping carts, the cash registers that Mary Jo talked about. Everyone plays equally at the library so far.
Well, call us about your trucks and muffin tins, whatever childhood toy you remember fondly. 816-235-2888. We've got Kelly in Overland Park on the line. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning, and thank you for having this conversation, and thanks to your guests for being there. I think it's a great one. I had two brief things. I had a favorite toy as a child, which was a shape sorter. I saved it, gave it to my daughter, and she loved it. She used it not only as a shape sorter, but she and her friends would do a lot of imaginative play with it. They would pretend that little shapes were jewels and they'd go on a treasure hunt, or they'd use them as coins while they were playing, store of some sort. So it was used for all sorts of different purposes other than just learning how to sort shapes.
Explain that for those of us who aren't quite recognizing what you mean by shape sorter.
Oh, well, this one happened to be a big cube that opened up, and it had on each side of the cube it had openings of different shapes, for instance a star, a circle, a triangle, and then there were little shapes that were made that would only fit into a little star shape that fit into the star shape hole, a little circle shape that fit just into the circle hole. And so the activity that it's meant for is to put that particular shape, the correct shape, into the correct shape. If they tried to put the circle into the star shape, obviously that wouldn't work, and they'd have to hunt for the correct shape to put it in. Did that make sense?
Yeah, so you and your daughter both loved that, and it sounds like you used it very differently.
Absolutely, and used it she used it very creatively, and I'm happy to hang on to it for her if she has children of her own one day. But I also wanted to make a comment, if I could, on what your guest talked about earlier about using screens for children. And it's not that there's anything intrinsically wrong with that, but you don't want it to take the place of other types of interaction. I guess I'm a really old school mom, but it does make me sad when I'm out and about and I see, for instance, in the grocery store, I see kids in the cart and their mom or dad pushing it, and mom and dad is having a chatty conversation with a friend while they're grocery shopping and not interacting with the kids, not saying, oh, doesn't this orange smell good? And isn't this which is the red apple, which is the green apple? Or, and I'm sorry to see the parental use of screens sometimes taking place of good interaction with the kids. It's not just giving the kids the screens, but it's the parents using screens wisely so that they're not using a screen, a phone, a tablet, in lieu of time they could be spending with their child, chatting with them in a waiting room instead of checking their email, that sort of thing. So that's just an old school mom comment.
Thanks, Kelly. Do you think a lot of people out there struggle with how to maintain that face-to-face kind of interaction with their children when so much of the business they need to conduct in their own social interactions are happening through that screen?
Yeah, I think absolutely a lot of parents do struggle with that. So we talked about screen use for kids, but screen use for parents is something that I think some parents are concerned about. And I think a lot of us have had the experience that it's very easy to get sucked into screens. You know, you sit down at the computer to check one thing, and 20 minutes later, you're on your third Wikipedia article about some obscure, Russian band or something like that. It really can happen. And so I think it is important for parents to think about, not only how their kids are using screens, but how they themselves are using screens, and that they're not interfering with their interactions with kids. One of the other things I think that research shows us is that sort of background use of screens, so sort of putting the television on for background noise and leaving it on basically all the time, that can be detrimental for kids. It kind of disrupts their play and disrupts their ability to focus on what they're doing. And so I think we want our use of screens to be intentional. So as Bradley talked about, thinking about the content, thinking about the context, but also just that if you're going to be watching TV, watch TV. Don't just leave it on in the background, because that's not going to be so helpful for your kids.
The balance too, Jean, if I may, is also the parents are connected and they need to be connected for job, for work, for family. But the kids have the desire to touch these screens and work with these screens and see what happens and make it happen. But then doing that with your child, talking about what's going on, what app are you doing, what are you going to do next, if you press that, what will happen or what do you think will happen, and then what are we going to do when we turn this off, setting up the time, okay, well, we're going to play this until I finish, until we get to wherever we're going, and then what are we going to do after it goes back into the bag, setting up that expectation that there is a time when we're going to finish this and we're going to do something else.
So turning it off is part of the game, as it were.
Exactly.
Let's hear from William, who has an interesting perspective on computers in children's lives. Good morning, William.
Hi. Well, this might go against what some of your experts are saying, but we had a computer growing up, and I played a lot of computer games, and at one point, my dad wanted me to be doing something else and told me that all I did on there was play games. So to prove him wrong, I wrote a little program, and now I'm a professional software developer.
So could it be argued, I think that what I'm kind of hearing William say is that you could argue that this is a form of literacy in its own right, working with these tools. How do you negotiate that important kind of learning with not letting it take over your life?
Right. I mean, I think absolutely there can be creative ways to use a computer just like there are creative ways to use any other tools. And certainly learning programming and kids today do that, developing new skins for games and things like that. So absolutely that can be a thing. I think a lot of it is about balance. So you want to have a balance of computer use, but also reading and time outside and things like that. So it's not that any of these things are bad in and of themselves, but just we don't necessarily want kids to be spending all of their time with any one type of play, or at least that it's might something that parents might want to talk to the kids. When you're on the computer, what are you doing? Are you doing something creative, or are you learning, or are you just kind of vegging out? And it's not bad to have time that's vegging out either. I think we all need some of that in our days, but you don't want it to take over.
Well, we're going to get to lots of calls about toys and what their specific purposes and memories are with lots of you. 816-235-2888 if you'd like to join that group. But let's turn now to Rebecca Cho, who is a coordinator for play therapy at Mid-America Nazarene University. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Tell us, what is play therapy?
Well, play therapy is the medium that we use when we're working with children or with adults that have experienced trauma. And what we actually do is we use different types of toys that allow that nonverbal expression. What we know is sometimes children have a very difficult time expressing or talking about their feelings or possibly the things that they have experienced. And adults who have experienced trauma at younger ages also have a very difficult time expressing in a cognitive level. So what we do as play therapists is we use different toys that allow that expression so that clients are able to process their experiences in a non-threatening way and find a solution to their emotional distress.
Can you give us an example of this, a child whose play really informed your ability to interact with him or her and understand what had happened and what the needs were?
Definitely. Sometimes some of the work that we do over here at our center is working with kids that had been internationally adopted. And they came to treatment because they were having a lot of anger issues. And, you know, children might be having outbursts and being just feeling out of control, but they're not able to verbalize, why do I feel out of control? This little kiddo came and played for many sessions in our play session. And a couple of the things that he will always do is he will come into the session and he will grab different categories of animals and he will group them. Whatever animals didn't really fit in that category, he will just toss aside and say, they don't belong to this family. They are not, they don't look alike. They just don't belong to this family. After several sessions of this type of play, which is what we call traumatic play, he got to a point when he did again the categories, but he started putting some of the extra animals as part of the family. And he will say something like, well, this one doesn't look the same as the other animals, but they can be part of this family because this family loves them no matter who they are. And that was a breaking point for this child because he was able to actually see that it didn't matter that he didn't look the same as the family that he belonged to. It was his special family. And after that, the behaviors actually decreased at home.
How do you go from that original state where a child is playing with the toy in a way that reflects something that's very painful and difficult or maybe even a deep misunderstanding? How do you transform that into something healthier and something, I mean, how does that transformation happen?
And that is something that we do a lot in play therapy. When you're working with people that had experienced trauma, even something as deep as sexual trauma, when clients come into the session and they are able to be accepted unconditionally and respected, and you allow them to process their experience in a way that feels non-threatening, the client is able to feel empowered to understand that they are valuable and that what happened to them does not define them. And the client, I think sometimes children are not given so much of the opportunity to understand and take ownership and control over their own lives. And that's why we see some of these behavioral actions outside of the play session. Also, you know, so many times adults come to therapy because also who have experienced sexual abuse, and they are able to, through play or through art, be able to put in a cognitive way what happened to them and find the empowering part of that. Through play therapy techniques that can be focused on empowerment, adults can and adolescents can actually gain that knowledge of being able to process their history of abuse without feeling so powerless and out of control.
Thank you so much, Rebecca Cho. I really appreciate your speaking with us today.
I did wanted to talk also a little bit about technology. I had been listening to the other people around the thing.
Yeah, please weigh
and
in on that.
The things that we are actually, right now, play therapy is really trying to understand how technology fits into our environment. We have beautiful playrooms set up over here with lots of toys, but we have found out not everybody has the opportunity to have a fully stocked playroom. So in the past few months, we had been partnering with different companies like Full Stack Technologies, and we have actually started to create some iPad apps that can allow the connection between the child and the screen. We have a play therapy book, and the children can learn how to do play therapy. And the reason I do want to agree with a lot of what the presenters were talking about is the most important toy in the playroom, the most important piece of the iPad interaction is not so much the iPad, is that connection with the therapist. And that significant adult that can be there and can be unconditionally supportive to the child is what makes the difference. So even in play, we are seeing the use of different tablets as part of that physical growth that do need to happen, because these new generations are different types of generations, and technology is part of their everyday life.
Thank you. For us, not so much. Thank you so much. I do want to get back to something that you said a moment ago, talking about not only generations, but the idea that adults process things through play as well, not just in situations of trauma, I assume, but in other contexts, because we don't entirely stop playing as adults, do we, Megan Patterson?
No, absolutely. So we continue to play as adults. We get together with friends to play cards or sports or things like that. And I think there's several things that play can do as adults. So certainly it can help us to build relationships when we're getting together with friends or family to engage in these activities. It helps us build those relationships. It also just provides a source of enjoyable activities. You know, play is fun. And so doing whatever we find enjoyable can really help to contribute to our happiness. I think there is also some evidence that even as we move into adolescence and adulthood, we may use play to help deal with some of those emotions like Dr. Cho was talking about. So that idea of using play to deal with feelings of frustration or anger or things like that. I think a lot of adults, for example, who play video games talk about using video games as an outlet for those feelings of frustration or other negative kinds of feelings.
Let's turn to Barbara and Olathe for some of her childhood memories with toys. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi there. Actually, I'm a grandmother, and who used to do a lot of babysitting when my little granddaughters were little. And I used to try to get them away from the non-computer kinds of things and just be creative in other ways. And one day I had a brainstorm and decided, let's play jewelry store. So I got a little old suitcase and cleared out all of my costume jewelry, put it in let the girls, they were about 5 to 8, they just absolutely organized that into a jewelry store. One of them was the clerk. One of them was the customer. They put prices on everything. They would kind of bargain back and forth with each other. And the funny part of it is the youngest girl is now teaching in Springfield. And when she came back to visit us recently, she said, "Do you still have the jewelry store box?" And that's the one thing from her childhood that she really remembers well.
It sounds like Barbara, it was not just encouraging creative play with her children, but she was being creative, in fact, in what she was helping them to play. What about creativity on the part of adults?
Well, and to your point, too, Gina, with it, Barbara used something she had in her home. She didn't have to go out and buy something. And my apologies to Mary Jo for not pushing sales her way. But there are a lot of things in your home that you can use to impact, substantially your child's development in literacy and social skills and understanding. I applaud that she went in and she found something that she could do right there to play together with her grandchildren.
Let's hear now from Becky in North Kansas City. Hi, Becky.
Yes, good morning. I don't want to continue on a negative note, but I was just wondering if there's any negative issues about play. For instance, even though our family receives a great deal of joy in watching our grandson play with his Legos, he is almost obsessed with them. He will certainly create a lot of things from Legos that have come apart, and so he makes great things. But when he comes home from school, instantly he'll go to his Legos, and it's as if his little brain is relaxing and having fun, and that's fine, and I never, or his mother and father, never ever discourage that. But is there any kind of play that can, especially with boys that become obsessive, not to the exclusion perhaps of not playing with other things? He plays well with other children, etc.
Right. And, Becky, let's let Megan Patterson answer that. Is obsession with a toy dangerous to development?
I think it's not uncommon for kids to go through stages where they're particularly focused on a specific toy. There are some children who are more prone to that. So kids with autism spectrum disorders, for example, do tend to become very focused on specific toys or specific kinds of activities. But it's not at all uncommon in neurotypical children, so children without autism spectrum disorders, to become very focused on a particular toy or type of toy for certain periods of time. So the earlier caller who was talking about his dad said he felt like the kid never did anything other than work on the computer. So it's not unusual, and I wouldn't be concerned about it, particularly in a situation where he can interact well with other kids and that kind of thing. Some kids just really like a particular thing, and in some cases, that's really an indicator of a high level of ability in that area.
Rebecca Cho, would you be at all concerned about a child who is obsessed with a particular toy?
In that specific area, I agree. I agree with what the previous presenter was talking about. One of the reasons that some children get really connected with a toy might have to do more with the level of mastery, and it has to do more of the level of expression that that toy actually provides for this child, especially at the age that she was describing. A lot of the boys at this developmental age will love things that they can come, and they feel an attachment to it because it allows them to work on those mastery pieces that they are doing during that period of time. Again, there are some diagnoses when you will see some of this repetitive play, but a lot of children that come back from school are so overwhelmed by what they have experienced throughout the day that they might attach when they come to school to a toy that allows them that expression of emotional distress.
Thank you so much. Well, I'd like to extend a huge thanks to today's guests, Megan Patterson, Mary Jo Ward, and Bradley Debrick. And then we also spoke just now with Coordinator for Play Therapy at Mid-America Nazarene University, Rebecca Cho. It was fun talking with you all this morning. And thanks to our listeners for calling in and tweeting us with stories about childhood toys. To listen to today's conversation again or to download a podcast of any of our past shows, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us at the same time tomorrow to hear from Chip Taylor, a guy who's been doing everything in his power to track and reverse the decline of monarch butterflies, whose habitats are declining at a rate of 6,000 acres a day in the United States. Listen in as well to hear Chip Taylor share his research on bees. That and more tomorrow. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Christy Garten and intern Kate Baxendale. Suzanne Hogan is our announcer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you've been listening to Central Standard. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.